speed to the work along the roads.
As the police followed the tracks of the thieves, they also seized closed-circuit TV footage of the armed men taken during the raid. But the quality of the images was poor.
The cameras in the building were not very good and didn't give us a lot at all. There should have been better pictures, particularly inside the museum.
Meanwhile, at the museum, people were still coping with the trauma caused by the robbery.
I did take care of the staff, the guards and the staff around, because I could see they have a traumatic moment in their lives. Everybody who was working that day didn't imagine it would happen.
Indeed, the Norwegian public was shocked by the loss of the Munch masterpieces. The museum itself came under attack for the lack of security. Why hadn't more been done to protect these national treasures?
I think most people were astonished that these valuable paintings weren't secured better.
The museum thought that criticism of its security was unfair.
When it comes to armed robbery, it is not so very much you can do. The newspapers wrote that it was only to go in and take the paintings off the wall. But it wasn't. You had to have a gun.
I don't think it was fair, because we are running on a budget, and the budget didn't say we had the money to install any more systems.
We were a little bit hurt and annoyed by the criticism, because we thought that we had done the best we could under the circumstances.
However unfair the criticism, the museum was closed while a new security system was installed to protect the Munch masterpieces. A leading security company was called in to help.
With the Munch Museum, that's a difficult task because it's a small museum. So the distances are very short and there are no stairs, so it will be quite easy to run through the building. I think most Norwegian felt that someone was taken that belonged to all of them.
I thought that was kind of a far reach myself. If I have $7 million worth of books, I'm not sending a 20-year-old to represent me. I have a son the same age, and he attended local high school. Well, there's probably a shot that he might know one of these kids. So he looked at the photographs, instantly recognized Spencer Reinhardt, and knew the kid of the other, ended up being Warren Lipka. One of them gave the cell phone number up. And of course, that was a huge mistake.
And I said, "You mean the cell phone in your pocket that's registered to your name?" I called his phone and I put it on speaker. His voicemail had his actual name. You know, "Hey, this is Spence, leave it." It was just a matter of time until we were actually caught. When the FBI actually arrested us, it was about 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. My girlfriend woke me up and she was screaming, "Chaz, Chaz, someone's in the house, someone's in the house." I ran over to the closet, grabbed a gun. That's when I heard someone beating on the door. I'm standing at the top of the stairs with the gun trained at the bottom of the stairs. Next thing I know, someone in full SWAT gear comes through the doorway at the bottom of the stairs. And my first instinct is I trained the gun on his face, and we locked eyes for just a brief second.
I hear one of my guys challenging an individual on the stairs, telling him to drop the gun. And for whatever reason, my guy did not pull the trigger. Chaz put the gun aside.
In that moment, I realized that I was caught, and I realized that they were going to prison.
I finally decision was made that the pictures would leave Austria, there was a national outcry. There was lots of criticism, and I was like, why do we have to give the pictures away? Why couldn't you find another way of handling this matter, of buying the pictures, you know, because everybody thought we would have enough money to get at least one of the pictures back, or two. But that wasn't the case. So a lot of people felt sad and felt about a missed chance. And so many people stormed, not stormed, but so many people went to the gallery to have a last look at the Klimt pictures.
One aspect on the Austrian side is a certain lack of coordination in this case, or maybe a lack of leadership. So I don't think they had a plan A, so they did not need a plan B.
This story began in 1938 with the Nazis looting the Blockbau Klimts in Vienna. The paintings were locked in Austria for 68 years. For the first time since they were looted, they were leaving Vienna.
Erich says to them, there's nothing going on. They ask, who else is in the museum? There's one other guard. Call him down. Erich has a two-way radio. He calls down Randy.
With the whereabouts of the Rubens sketch unknown, Klaus Trugzig of Stockholm's police led the investigation. He needed to know more about Harold Leith, the man who had brought the painting to the National Gallery.
Get a telegraph from Interpol in Stockholm. That was part of the investigation. I only have this name, Harald Leith, and he was not in our files. I called him about the painting.
Leith, a local artist in Stockholm, was brought in for questioning. He told police he was simply helping a friend authenticate a painting.
I don't think he realized that was the real one. He told me that the friend of his have given the painting to him.
Leith was able to give police a vital lead, the phone number of his friend, Moll Merner.
I talked to Bo Merner, and that was the same day, and I get the name Ramon.
All the police knew about Ramon was that he was Moll Merner's brother-in-law.
I called Ramon, told him I want to speak to him, and he come to the police station. We have a good speak, and he told me something about this painting, and he don't have the painting in his hand.
Ramon claimed he owned the painting, but he insisted that it was not an original Rubens.
He acted like a businessman. He was not nervous, poker face.
Ramon told police he had taken the painting to a local gallery and had asked them to sell it. They sent the painting first to Sotheby's in London, who then passed it on to their New York office for authentication and auction. Stockholm police were worried that with the painting out of Swedish jurisdiction, they had to act fast to stop it slipping from their hands forever. They contacted Sotheby's and were able to persuade them to return the painting to Sweden. Klaus now had the stolen painting safely in custody. He decided to bring Ramon in for questioning. He discovered that he had two low-paying jobs as a chauffeur and a cleaner.
So I want to know how he get the painting and why.
Ramon came up with a bizarre explanation. He claimed he was working with two South American students who had the painting and wanted $30,000 for it.
Told me that this South American was studying in Leningrad to finance the guerrilla movement in South America. I don't believe him, but we have to check it up.
The police investigated the cleaning company where Ramon said the students worked.
We can't find anything that say that he has right or wrong.
Klaus asked Ramon where he got the money to buy the painting. Once again, Ramon had the answers ready.
He have a loan from his brother who have contact with the bank in Spain.
We feel that these pictures, they belong to us and they belong to the next generation. We can't allow something like that happening again.
But interest in the fate of the Scream spread rapidly around the world.
Of course, it was a very media-friendly story, with an armed robbery, you know, violence, art. It was dramatic. I was not surprised that people, that the press from England and the States and Germany and France and Italy were interested. I was not surprised by that. But I got telephones from the Philippines and from China and from Australia and from Peru and everywhere. And that surprised me.
The media hype was understandable. The Scream was, after all, one of the most famous images in modern art.
It's an icon, and it's the most copied and used motif of all artwork, more
than
the Mona
Lisa.
When committing
a robbery, every split second counts. They crashed one.
So it must speak to us in a certain way.
This was how Munch himself described the painting in his own diary.
Nissa 22 i första.
I was walking along a path with two friends. The sun was setting. I felt a breath of melancholy. Suddenly the sky turned blood red. I stood there trembling with anxiety, and I felt a great, infinite scream pass through nature.
At 1 a.m. on Sunday, many were still partying. Others had jobs to do.
A mansion. It was built well over 100 years ago.
Surprised at the pounding, was doubly surprised to see it was the police.
Bob, can I get you to come on down here?
10-4, copy that.
Something kind of odd going on.
Roger, I'll be right there, I'm on my way.
The officer told the bewildered guard that someone from the museum had reported a disturbance.
I didn't report any disturbance here.
The guard tried to convince the officers that everything was in order. The police insisted on checking out the museum themselves.
The criminal plan of the thieves, using the two bogus police officers to enter the Gardner Museum, was quite simple and quite easily executed. The Gardner Museum could have been as secure as Fort Knox, but that does no good if the guard's going to let the thief in.
Even the most finely tuned security system can be undone by the simplest human miscalculation. The guard, lured from his post, had had no time to press the panic button. No alarm had been tripped.
But when Klaus contacted the bank, they had never heard of Ramon.
There was something wrong about what he told me.
Klaus had enough evidence to apply for a search warrant from the state prosecutor.
It was my decision to look around in his apartment.
Police raided Ramon's apartment in Stockholm looking for evidence. They were also searching for the second Rubens painting stolen from La Coruña, the Aurora.
The Aurora sketch was not found in his home.
But the police did have one lucky break. They found Ramon's passport, and it provided a vital clue.
We find his Swedish passport, and we check up the stamps and find that he was in Spain at the time of the theft.
The passport proved that Ramon was in La Coruña at the time of the theft, but the police still had no evidence to prove he stole the paintings.
Klaus Trotzig and me, we instinctively knew this is the thief in La Coruña.
I was questioning him 7 times.
The police discovered details of Ramon's background and his childhood in Spain.
As a child, he was living in La Coruña.
Painting was stolen from a museum in Spain, about 5 minutes walk from his home.
We could find on a map that his school and the museum was on one line from his home.
They call in the museum security director, who immediately notifies the local police. Upon their arrival, the police search the building high to low. They eventually find the guards still tied up in the museum basement. The FBI takes immediate control of the case, explaining that the artwork could likely cross state lines. They sweep the museum, leaving no corner untouched.
The intruders must have known about the surveillance system because they quickly put it out of commission. They turned the cameras to face the wall and dismantled the printer that recorded activity from the sensors in every room.
But they're not quite identical. Of course, we like ours best, so we hope that we will get it back.
The pressure on the police to find the missing masterpieces was intense. In the hours immediately after the raid, officers traced the escape route taken by the thieves, thanks to the pieces of broken frames.
We probably pass the way to when he go to school.
He has passed that museum many, many times as a child.
The evidence was circumstantial. Hans couldn't prove he stole the painting, but he could charge Ramon with handling stolen goods.
Not the thief, but handling stolen goods. It's second best.
Hans took the case to the district court in Stockholm.
The individuals claiming to be Boston police officers tell the guard at the desk, "Can I see your ID?" And at that point, the alleged officers say, "There's a warrant out for your arrest."
And Rick says, no, I don't want it for anything. By stepping away, he is going to be out of reach from hitting the alarm bell. The one security alarm bell the museum has to the outside world.
And at that point, they place handcuffs on the first guard. The other guard who came down to the first floor, they tell him to get up against the wall.
And Randy's going, "Oh my God, what is going on? What did Rick do?" But then no sooner is he wondering this than he's being handcuffed.
That's when the one bad guy declared, "Gentlemen, this is a robbery."
The fake police take control of the real guards and tell them what will happen if they tell the cops anything about the robbery.
It was well planned. They knew how many guards were on duty.
It's not pretty.
They knew where the videotape machine was.
On January 12, 1987, where Ramon was charged with being in possession of a stolen Rubens painting. But Ramon pleaded not guilty, claiming the painting was not the original, but a copy.
No one knew the intruders were in the museum, and the morning guard wasn't due until 7. That gave them hours to perform their illicit task.
We now know who you are and where you live. Keep quiet, cooperate, and don't ever say anything, or we're gonna come hunt you down.
They proceed to tape their eyes so they can't see where they're going, and then they're moved, and both led down to the basement.
They run weeks of intense analysis, collaborating across departments. Shockingly, they find no physical evidence, no footprints, no hair, no fingerprints. They pivot to relying on first-hand witness accounts. Based on witness descriptions, they compile a list of potential leads.
Rick Abbott,
a museum security guard.
Whitey Bulger,
a powerful Boston criminal.
Brian McDevitt,
a con man with a history of attempted art heists.
As bold as the thieves were, they didn't make the most of their opportunity.
They had the whole museum to themselves in the dark of night. They could have pulled a truck up and removed $1 billion worth of art, and instead they took a few valuable things and left behind an extraordinarily valuable assortment of paintings that, you know, fortunately, are still there.
Despite their expertise at breaking in, they seemed somewhat at a loss for which pieces to take or how to take them. Rembrandt's only seascape, Storm on the Sea of Galilee, was sliced out of its frame with a dull knife.
I could follow this car up to a place not far from the museum.
I found it a couple of hours after the armed robbery next to this tennis court.
It was here that the gang almost certainly had a second vehicle waiting for them.
Once they had parked the car here, they were picked up by one or two other vehicles, or they had one or two other vehicles already parked here.
The same fate awaited Rembrandt's Lady and Gentleman in Black. They also took a painting by Vermeer. In their assault of the gardener, they helped themselves to a small self-portrait of Rembrandt and some less valuable works, including a 3,000-year-old Chinese vessel and the finial from a Napoleonic battle flag. There seemed no rhyme or reason behind the choices they made. The sensors in each room indicated they'd spent 2 hours moving about the museum. Given that amount of time, the devastation of the paintings was all the more senseless.
Although it's considered by many people the art crime of the century, and in terms of value and in terms of sort of impact it is, if you look at the details of it, it was also a botched crime. It was a crime in which a lot of good works of art that were there for the taking were missed, and artwork that was taken was cut from its frames, which is obviously not something you want to do with irreplaceable Rembrandts.
The thieves' behavior suggested they weren't acting alone.
What I suspect from that is that the robbers were recruited as robbers. My guess is they'd never done an art theft before. I very much suspect that there were other people behind the theft besides the two bogus police officers.
When it was over, the thieves made off with 13 objects, estimated worth $200 to $300 million. Sunday morning, 7 a.m., March 18th, 1990. The daytime guard at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum was puzzled when the night guards didn't come to the door. He waited until the maintenance man arrived. Neither had a key. They knew something wasn't right. Where were the guards? The museum's head of security arrived to let them in. His quick inspection of the rooms revealed no guards, missing artwork, and big trouble. rush to call the police. After their rescue, the guards gave their accounts of the night before. But it all happened too fast. Their descriptions of the thieves were hopelessly sketchy. Police sought better clues elsewhere in the museum. The thieves had been sloppy removing the art. Detectives hoped they had been careless enough to leave a fingerprint or more. But no traces of their identities remained. Investigators would have to widen the search.
After an art theft takes place, there are several things you do, and two important things which come to mind are, number one, to look to your network of underworld informants, and number two, to try to catch up with the stolen objects and use them to work your way back toward the thieves.
Though the Gardner Museum and all its treasures are private property, art theft is a federal crime, the FBI's domain. Agents wasted no time comparing this theft to similar ones and gathering a list of suspects. They trusted that their network of informants would bring some other names to light. A heist this big couldn't stay secret. The small museum offered a $1 million reward for any information leading to the return of the artwork. An unprecedented sum, four times higher than any reward ever offered. But then, this was the biggest art theft of all time. If stolen artwork isn't recovered within a few days, it can vanish for decades, or forever, as it's sold to unwitting buyers and ends up in private collections. Agents needed to cover a lot of ground very quickly. They visited galleries and auction houses to see what they could find in terms of tangible goods or...
He made a very nice impression. I could have met him normally as a friend in a party or something, drinking wine and talking about picture, because he was so nice and so decent and civilized.
In court, Hans confronted Ramon about the inconsistencies in his story. The passport stamps, the elusive students who said he sold him the painting, and the question of how he could afford to buy the painting, working as a cleaner and chauffeur.
I couldn't in court get him upset. He behaved himself, he was never upset. Never. Whatever he says, it's not right, it's a lie.
But however cool Ramon remained, the court did not believe his story, and he was convicted of handling the stolen painting.
As well as a number of suspects tied to the Boston Mafia. But the case doesn't go away. In 1994, museum director Ann Holly receives a strange letter. She tears open the envelope and proceeds with caution. It's an anonymous note from someone claiming to be negotiating a return of the artwork. This letter is different from the many others she's received. It's articulate, non-threatening, instructive.
I want to point out that I had no part in the theft,
the individual wrote,
and only became aware of it in the past 6 months. Further, I do not know the identity of the two men who did the actual robbery. I am dealing with a third party.
The writer explains that the artwork was stolen to reduce a prison sentence. But now, the opportunity had passed, there's no longer a reason to keep the artwork. The letter goes on to say that the thieves want immunity for themselves and all others involved.
It's a barbaric act. Given that these pieces are very well known, who could possibly keep them?
That's a very good question. Only probably a person who is determined to keep them private for the rest of their life.
One of the most valuable paintings stolen from the Gardner is this. It's The Storm on the Sea of Galilee by Rembrandt. And traditionally, Rembrandt's been very popular amongst art thieves. In this instance, the thieves really struck gold because this picture, it's Rembrandt's only seascape. And it contains a self-portrait of the artist in the midst of the melee, holding onto his hat and staring out at the viewer. It was painted in 1633, and it depicts a famous biblical scene
of Jesus with his disciples in a fishing boat that's got into all sorts of trouble as it's been struck by a tempest. And to show off his talent, Rembrandt's deliberately decided to depict this moment of maximum danger when all of those disciples are about to lose faith. They fear that they're about to die, only before they're then calmed by the contrasting, very calm and serene figure of Christ himself sitting in the boat. It's an example of a young artist flexing the muscles of his artistic powers. But the storm on the Sea of Galilee isn't the most valuable painting in the Garden of Lute. That honor belongs to this. It's The Concert by the 17th century Dutch artist and contemporary of Rembrandt, Jan Vermeer. It's a typical Vermeer scene of well-heeled people making music in a very refined, opulent interior. But all isn't quite as straightforward as it seems, because this is very much a world of artifice. It contains these paintings within paintings, two Arcadian landscapes. But then there's this image, this third painting. It presents a brothel goer who's interested in a prostitute who's playing a lute, whilst this old crone of a procuress is negotiating a fee. Maybe we're meant to try and draw some subtle comparisons between them.
As a prosecutor, you don't look too much in their faces, but I notice in the eye he is just cold and
But if Hans thought that was the end of the story, he was wrong.
And $2.6 million.
For the return. If the museum is interested in negotiating, they should
print a coded message in the Sunday edition of the Boston Globe.
Holly believes this to be a strong lead. She quickly contacts the FBI, who gets in touch with the Globe. The coded message is printed on May 1st, 1994. A few days later, Holly receives a second anonymous letter from the same source, confirming the message had been received. It mentions that the thieves need some time to evaluate their options. Holly never hears from the writers again. The case goes cold. No new updates, no new leads, no new evidence. Until 2022, when authorities reveal a new clue. Jimmy Marks, a known career criminal who may be linked to the heist. Marks spent time in prison for a bank robbery in the 1960s, and was a drug dealer with many connections among the Boston criminal elite. On a cold February evening, 11 months after the museum robbery, Marks was shot and killed while unlocking the front door to his apartment in a Boston suburb. The killer had unscrewed the light bulb over the door to ensure Marks wouldn't see what was coming. The murderer shot Marks twice in the back of the head and fled the scene. According to the tip received just days before he died, Marks was reportedly heard bragging about possessing two of the stolen museum paintings. Authorities followed up, but found no evidence that Marks was involved. To this day, the case is unsolved. No arrests have been made. No art has been recovered. In 1990, the FBI estimated the value of the heist at $200 million.
Ramon appealed his conviction at the district court, and his lawyer came up with an ingenious defense. Ramon may only have been a chauffeur and cleaner, but he was able to hire the best and most expensive lawyer in Sweden. He claimed the painting could not possibly be the same Rubens that was stolen in Spain. It was 5 millimeters smaller.
He made a very, very good job trying to prove that it wasn't the original Rubens. they talk about small difference. 5 millimeters smaller. He's the best lawyer. So we lost the case.
Idle gossip. Despite all their efforts, they found nothing. That wasn't entirely surprising. Some paintings are simply too conspicuous to sell.
I think we have to ask ourselves why at the high end they would bother with a Vermeer painting, which most people would call unfenceable. No criminal would touch it because there's only 30-some-odd Vermeers in the world, and therefore they're very noticeable. It's like everybody knows where each one of them is supposed to be.
Sometimes famous works are stolen simply in order to ransom them back to the museum for the insurance or reward money. If that was the robbers' game, they had wasted their efforts.
Up on the rooftop, skulking about in the shadows, a thief is going about his business. Now, police have got a theory. They think that this thief took advantage of scaffolding to get up onto the roof of the Ashmolean Museum. And he made his way across till he found the skylights that he was looking for. And he removed a section of the glass and, using a rope ladder, then lowered himself into the museum.
The thief dropped a smoke canister, which set off the fire alarm.
The museum was unable to increase it. Authorities were literally at a dead end. The clock was running. Authorities believed the art would keep changing hands between shady sellers and naive buyers, erasing the trail of the real thieves. As the months crept by, authorities feared that the Gardner Hall was destined to be part of the 75% of stolen art that is never recovered. Then, 7 years after the crime in 1997, the FBI convinced the museum's supporters to pool their resources, enabling the desperate Gardner Museum to increase the reward from $1 million to $5 million.
So Paul Engay had stolen a Munch painting in the 1980s. He had been convicted of stealing one of Munch's screams in the 1990s. But despite this, police soon decided he was not a prime suspect for the armed robbery in 2004. But there was someone who knew precisely where they were.
Today, our dealer suggests the hall could be worth $600 million. The Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum theft is considered one of the highest value museum robberies of all time, frequently mentioned across TV, film, and pop culture.
When those guards didn't know if they were going to live or die.
With the guards under control, the man now have free reign of the entire museum.
But that meant guards couldn't enter the gallery. Fire regulations prevented it. Quick, cunning, and with a particularly inventive use of a smoke bomb, you can see why it reminded so many of the Thomas Crown affair. This was the thief's target, the view of Auvers-sur-Oise by Paul Cézanne. Cézanne is an exceptionally important figure in modern art. Picasso called him the father of us all because he laid the foundations for the radical developments of cubism.
The highest court in the land, the Swedish Supreme Court.
I was desperate because I was so convinced that it was the original just because of a shrinking oak.
But how to prove it? Then Gorel came up with a dramatic way of proving the painting was the genuine stolen Rubens.
I could take a transparency photo of the painting and another photo from the book. Then they called me as a witness.
The mysterious Ramon.
This is one. I was just a bit angry that I couldn't prove that he was the thief in La Coruña.
At the meeting, two Latin males arrive with a briefcase. And that was the first time we knew of anybody else besides Orly being involved. The painting was produced from the briefcase.
This is very different to the idea of a billionaire aficionado stealing art just for the love of it. It's not simply about selling art back onto the market. It seems that art can be used by thieves as a kind of underworld currency.
But their movements are still being tracked by the
greasing the wheels of the criminal economy. And that explains why great paintings have been targeted for decades. Following the theft, there were several questions.
Shares with some
who was
of the Oslo
the
underworld?
And what were their
motives? Would bring him face to face with the screen.
You know, just come to the racetrack and watch me racing the times you are in Norway and do that. And I see them drop by the shop sometimes to see what kind of cars we got and, yeah, basically interested in cars.
The statute of limitations on the crime had expired 2 years earlier. The time was ripe for something to happen. While researching an unrelated story, Boston Herald reporter Tom Mashburn got a tip that a man named Miles Connor was involved with the Gardner caper.
Now, if you're from Massachusetts or you're familiar with any of the sort of recent crime lore of the Boston area, the one name that rings a lot of bells is Miles Connor. Miles is sort of famous for being a very successful art thief. Well, I guess not that successful because he spent a lot of time in jail.
In fact, Connor was in prison when the Gardner heist occurred. Mashburg learned that he had a
Tomas Natos William is Young. Such a fanatic that he travels around Europe to drag car race events. And he once used an old bus and trailer to transport his cars. That bus is now dumped next to his workshop on a farm outside Oslo.
I found him and I asked him, is it something in that bus that I have to worry about?
Skills at the weapons. So he knew very much about the cars and weapons. And,
didn't know what to do, actually. So, scream at Madonna.
What followed was a bloody shootout in the town center.
This being Sicily, one organization quickly came under suspicion.
Quindi questo significa che c'è un'entità dietro che può
throughout the building.
The dot matrix printer that is tracking movement through the galleries shows exactly where they went, for how long, and what they did there. It's the closest thing, I think, to sort of peeking through a keyhole and watching the whole thing unfold.
They had painting that they wanted to sell. Hank was playing the role of as the buyer's representative.
He didn't do a lot of talking at the meeting. The source did most of the talking. Hank just looked at the painting, made a couple of mental notes. He didn't know what he was looking for.
The meeting had been a success for both sides. Orly thought she had found a buyer, while Hank had seen the painting he thought was called The Dawn.
La verità è che non abbiamo certezze perché non sappiamo i nominativi delle persone che hanno fatto questo furto e non sappiamo la sorte del dipinto stesso.
For years there was silence. Then slowly, repentant mafia soldiers began to talk. And what they said was alarming. One, Gaspare Spetuzza, claimed the nativity was used as a trophy by mafia bosses and took pride of place at secret mob gatherings.
Hank came back.
However, he also claimed that after it was damaged, the bosses judged it worthless.
Opinione, dire se sta ancora in Italia o no, e se è stato distrutto o non è stato distrutto, oppure chi ce l'ha, è inutile, spesso siamo andati vicino.
Interesting way of communicating, just the way he said it was pretty funny at the time.
told us it's a painting on a thin piece of wood, and it's a fat lady sitting on a cloud holding a lamp in her hand.
And he had an interesting way of communicating. Just the way he said it was pretty funny at the time.
Told us it's a painting on a thin piece of wood, and it's a fat lady sitting on a cloud holding a lamp in her hand. Told us it's a painting on a thin piece of wood, and it's a fat lady sitting on a cloud holding a lamp in her hand. Told us it's a painting on a thin piece of wood, and it's a fat lady sitting on a cloud holding a lamp in her hand. Told us it's a painting on a thin piece of wood, and it's a fat lady sitting on a cloud holding a lamp in her hand. Told us it's a painting on a thin piece of wood, and it's a fat lady sitting on a cloud holding a lamp in her hand.
size of a pencil, where the bullet, the hole in the middle of his forehead, where the bullet went in, was about the size of a pencil. The hole in the back of his head, where the bullet came out, was big enough to put your fist in. If it was a small fist and you wanted to put it there, you could say about the hole in the back of his head where the heavy duck load came out. It was big enough to put your foot in, even if you didn't. This story from Tornado Alley, where he was going, is quite frankly based on The Snows of Kilimanjaro by Ernest Hemingway. In fact, there are several quotations, and where he was going is a quotation. Farm kitchen, blinds drawn, guns propped in corners. Plates and glasses have been shoved aside to make room for road maps. Four men lean over the maps. There is a basic sameness in the faces. Kerosene lamps cast a flickering light of death on cheekbones and lips, on the tired, alert eyes. Sure to have roadblocks here and here. Ishmael pours a generous portion of whiskey into a dirty glass. Couldn't we just hole up here? They don't rumble us moving out. They will close in for a house-to-house search. Makes sense. Let's try it here. And suddenly it occurred to him that he was going to die. Not sooner or later, he knew that, of course, they all did. But tonight, it came in a puff, the wind that makes a candle flicker, the sick, hollow fear hit him like a kick in the stomach. He doubled slightly forward, supporting himself on the back of a chair. It's always like this, he tells himself. The fear, and then a rush of courage and the clean, sweet feeling of being born. He read that somewhere in an old Western. But the fear can go on until you can't stand it. It's going to break you, and that's when the fear breaks, you hope. Let's go, he croaks. He wonders if they're all as scared as he is. His gun seems clumsy and heavy in his hands. Alien, malignant. Sure they are, but they don't talk about it. Click of hammers and breeches. They're in the car now, shutting the door. He is sitting by the car door on the right side. The road is full of holes and water in the holes and deep ruts. Please God we don't get stuck, seeing themselves stumbling around in the woods with the bloodhounds closing in. Stop, douse the light. Chug, chug. Another car coming this way, closer. The light coming around a corner of the narrow road between heavy timber. Ishmael gets out slow, his feet like blocks of wood, and stands in the middle of the road, his hands up. The old car sputters to a stop. Old gray man behind the wheel. Ishmael walks over slow and shows the old man the wallet. FBI. Ishmael's lips are numb. This is no pawn shop badge. It's a perfect replica of the real thing with cards to go with it. made up by a forger in Toronto. Cost $150. Flashed him out of some tight spots. The old man sits there with his face blank. We're looking for some bank robbers. Hold up around here. You live here long? 40 years. Must know the area. He brings out a road map. Now we've got roadblocks up here and here and here. Is there any other way they could get out? Yep. Old wagon road cuts in right here. Bit rough, but they can make it. Comes out on County Road 52. Yep, they could get clean away. If your information checks out, you'll be eligible for a reward of $500. He hands the old man a card. Just call the FBI office in Tulsa. I'll do that. I surely will. The old man drives on. The driver studies the map under the dashboard lights. Make it exactly 5 3/10 to the turnoff. Old man on the phone. That's right, posing as a G-man. Ishmael remembers old Doc Benway saying, "You face death all the time, and for that time, you are immortal." Raccoon crosses the road, its eyes bright green in the headlights. Not hurrying, slipping along. And it came with a rush, a sudden evil-smelling emptiness. And the raccoon was slipping lightly along the edge of it. Get away to Mexico. I've been there. Only way to live. Got 5 G's and a money belt. Go a long way down there. The fear is back around his chest like a soft bite squeezing the air out. The gun heavy in his hands, he knows he couldn't lift it. All the strength is running out of him in waves of searing pain. They pull around a corner and light jabs into his eyes and his brain explodes in a white flash. And he is free, throwing the door open, jumping out in the air as the windshield explodes, glinting yellow shards, and Tom throws a hand in front of his face. Very light on his feet, the Tommy gun light in his hands like a dream gun. When a sincere young agent, religious son of a bitch too, leaps to his feet, rifle level. He hasn't made his dog meat yet, as they call it. Animals, his fellow agents tell him. That's what they are, animals. And don't you forget it. Get down for Christ's sakes, bellows the DS. And Ish stitches 3.45s across the boy's lean young chest an inch apart. He has the touch. It's an instrument, Machine Gun Kelly told him. Play it. He must have dozed off in the car. Another shootout dream. He knows they have been driving all night. Home safe now. Coming down into a valley. Warm wind and a smell of water. From here you climb 10,000 feet to the pass. Remembers Mexico City and his first reef of cigarette. Went crazy on it, wonderful crazy, wandering down Nino Perdido, and everywhere he sees sugar skulls and fireworks, kids biting into the skulls. Dia de los Muertos, the boy tells him and smiles, showing white teeth and red gums. Very white, very red, whiter and redder than life. And he thought, why not? I'd done it in the reform school. The boy has a gardenia behind his ear. He wears a white, spotless cotton shirt and pants to the ankle with sandals.